Hi! Hey, welcome to the Cordial Catholica podcast for non-Catholics, for new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Keith Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? Well, that question led me into a deep dive into the history of my faith, history of the Bible, history of the church, you know, the Reformation, everything before that, everything after that, and beyond that. And for the very first time in this really deep, years-long journey, I encountered the Catholic Church in its own words, from actual Catholic sources, and realized for the very first time that what I thought I knew about the Catholic Church and what Catholics believed was based in large part on misinformation, and more often than not, on simple misunderstandings. Well, this podcast serves to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the very heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week, I am absolutely thrilled. I couldn't be more excited to bring you the conversation I had with Gerard Figarelli this week. Gerard was raised Catholic, born Catholic, had first confession, first communion, confirmation, the different early sacraments, and promptly, you know, left the Catholic Church at age 22 after having a really intense experience in the Baptist faith, at a Baptist church. He spent the next like 30-something years as an evangelical Christian, as a pastor, as a seminarian, a student of the great Norm Geisler, of Francis Beckwith, of these really heavy hitters in the evangelical world, at conferences, at these different presentations, doing the pastoral work, like digging deeply in the trenches, and had an experience, and then more experiences, and then more experiences, and then read an absolute ton of books, and began to realize that what he thought he knew about the Catholic faith of his childhood, of his upbringing, was, you know, that very thing that I experienced too, based on a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings. It was through that undoing and through some really intense, you know, heart-moving Holy Spirit experiences that Gerard and his wife, and now some children as well, which is fantastic, began to discern and reconcile, as Gerard says, with the Catholic Church. It's an amazing story. Gosh, he's a great storyteller. He talks for a long time, and I really just shut up for a long time and don't say anything, which I know you guys love, so here it is. You're welcome. Amazing story. I think you will love it. And I think there's a lot in here for many people. You know, the questions that Gerard and his wife encounter and ask, well, those are the questions that many of us encounter and ask as well. I think you'll love this conversation. These conversations on this show are brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic and our one-time sponsors at paypal.me/cordialcatholic. You guys help to keep this show going and growing with all the different kind of costs associated with this thing week after week. So thank you for that support. If you want to help the show, those links are in the show notes. And thank you to those who are already taking part in that thing. You guys are amazing. And now, without any further ado, my amazing conversation with Gerard Figarelli on his journey into the Catholic Church. It's an amazing one, guys. Please listen and enjoy. Hey friends, welcome back to the show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. If you are listening on podcast, thank you. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please make sure you follow the show and leave a rating or a review if you can, because those ratings and reviews help to push the podcast out to new people and spread the reach of conversations like this one on podcasts. And thanks for listening. If you're watching on YouTube, hey, thank you. Please join our growing channel, subscribe to the show, hit the bell, like this video, and interact in the comments. And thanks, guys, for watching. We are in for an absolute treat, guys. I am extremely excited to bring you this conversation with my guest, Gerard Figarelli. He was raised Catholic, but after a life-changing encounter with Christ at the age of 22, he swiftly converted to the Baptist faith. In addition to 10 years' experience as a senior pastor, Gerard has been a radio minister, a presenter at ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, and the National Conference on Apologetics, and was privileged to study under distinguished scholars such as the late Norman Geisler at Southern Evangelical Seminary and Dr. Francis Beckwith at Baylor University. And after 34 years as an evangelical, last year, Gerard began to dig more deeply into the claims of the Roman Catholic Church, along with his wife, was soon reconciled with the church. That's going to be a pretty cool story to hear. Gerard and his wife have been married for almost 32 years. They have 5 grown children and 1 grandchild who was just, in the matter of these last few weeks, received the sacrament of baptism. That's thrilling. Wonderful. Gerard, welcome to the show. I'm thrilled to have you. Thank you for being here, and hello.
Thanks for having me. In fact, my granddaughter was just baptized this past Saturday, so 3 days ago. So we're still riding the high of that great experience. So it's very exciting times. In fact, Keith, today is yesterday would have been 1 year to the day since my wife and I started this journey home. So this is just an exciting time for us right now. So, and it's very exciting to be on your show. I feel like I've known you because I've seen so many of your shows, and we have some common, some common friends and acquaintances. Yes. So this should be fun.
Yes, absolutely. I am thrilled. And I got to say, your wife was the one who first exposed me to your story. She wrote about it on a group that I was a part of. And I thought, this sounds really interesting. I watched a bit of a video. And I don't like to learn too much of your story in advance. I prefer being surprised and actually authentically like, oh, what? That's more interesting. But some of the names that popped up there, Francis Beckwith, we've had him on the show way back when. And for me, his conversion back to the Roman Catholic Church as a really important evangelical theologian was what? That happens? Yeah. I was floored, right? You also, you mentioned Norman Geisler in your story and Southern Evangelical Seminary. You know, Doug Beaumont, who's also a convert out of there, Evangelical Exodus is his book. He is, we call him the OG of this show. He was the very first guest I had on the show. The first guy that said yes, episode 3 or 4, I think it was, that he came on the show to tell his story. That was foundational for me, that book and that collection of conversion stories out of SES. Was huge for me. So when I read your story and I thought, Gerard, Beckwith, right? Geisler, SES, these places that, were really important in my story and my journey and many people's stories and journeys. I thought, I got to get this guy on the show. It just keeps getting better. I'm thrilled to hear your story. So I'm going to call you Gerard. I'm sure by mistake many times that the French I don't think
it's a French name.
It's a French name. It's just going to happen. And I apologize in advance if it comes out Gerard.
My mom would love it.
we'll say it's for your mom then. We'll keep it. That's fantastic. And listen, I'll get out of the way. I'll be quiet and I'll let you, unwind your story. It's a fantastic one. So go back as far as you want to go back and begin to unspin that for us. We'll stop along the way and jump in at points because there's lots to dig in here, but I'll get out of the way. Gerard and allons-y.
Well, that's the only French I might know is my name, and that's I don't even know it in French. But thank you very much for the introduction, and there's a lot of interesting connections here, and it's been an interesting road. So I'll just back up and go to the beginning just real quickly, to give a little bit of background. So I was raised in a Catholic family. I was baptized at I think 10 days old in Staten Island, New York. My family moved to Houston soon after. I was probably 3. And we got settled into a church on the north side of Houston where I received my first communion, I assume at age 7, I believe. And then I received confirmation about 2 weeks shy of my 16th birthday. So all very typical a Catholic to, receive those sacraments of initiation in roughly that time frame. However, the 10 months that followed my confirmation kind of makes you, think that the effects might have been delayed a little bit. So let me just describe the 10 months after my confirmation. And this kind of factors into the conversion I had later on at a Baptist church. So I was confirmed in April of 1883. Soon thereafter got my driver's license. Soon after that, I dropped out of high school. And I became so unruly at home. My dad had to kick me out of the house. He kicked me up to Omaha to live with my sister for a while. I was so unruly there, they had to kick me back home. Of course, my dad did this out of love. He was trying. He was fit to be tied with me. I was not an easy to handle young person. Well, maybe a week or two after I was sent back home to try to get things straightened out there, I was involved in a very serious car accident that was partially somebody else's fault and partially my fault for being probably several times over the legal limit when I drove. And I was very fortunate that worse did not come from that. It kind of woke me up a little bit, and I decided to re-enroll in school. Now, I'm 9 months from my confirmation at this point. I decided to re-enroll in school, and roughly 5 or 6 weeks after I re-enrolled, I was involved in another accident on the campus of my high school, and unfortunately this time it cost the life of one of my high school classmates, one of my friends. He was tragically killed in that accident, and I was just shy of my 17th birthday at this point, and you can imagine how that affects a young man. My parents were obviously distraught over the things that were happening, but they were extremely gracious and supportive and loving. If I remember correctly, even the parents of the young man that lost his life were very forgiving towards me. I think they might have been parishioners at my parents' church. I don't really remember that part of it. Nevertheless, I always describe this as a time when a light seemed to go out inside of me. It might seem a little dramatic, but it was just a terrible, dark time. And for the next several years, I really was aimless. I was rebellious. I was reckless in many ways. You can fill in the blanks. I don't need to get into details there because some of it was very typical of teenage rebellion and some of it was a little atypical. It was just a rough time. I did join the Navy when I was 19, and part of that was just following a friend in. But, the military will straighten you out a little bit. It will provide some structure, but it doesn't provide transformation. And here I got a pause to kind of, fill in a little blank of my high school year. So I dropped out of high school. I eventually went back, but I didn't read anything that they told me to read. There was two books I read my junior and senior years in high school. I read Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I mean, that's going back in the 80s. Nobody reads that book. And for some reason, I read that book. It was not assigned reading, I can assure you. And I read the dictionary. And I don't really know why. It's not like you can see the evidence of having read the dictionary, but I didn't learn a lot of important things in life. And one of the things I didn't learn was geography. And so when I was in the Navy, I had an opportunity to pick my orders, where I would be sent. They did give you some latitude and liberty. And I had a choice of 10 different places to go. And I chose the Philippines. It was one of the places on that list of 10. I chose the Philippines because I confused the Philippines with the Catalina Islands off the coast of California, because there's an island called the San Miguel, and San Miguel is a big name in the Philippines. And so I got shipped off to the Philippines, which is in fact an island off the coast of California, but a little bit further out there. So I ended up in the Philippines. I've since learned my geography a little bit better. Ended up in the Philippines for 2 years in the Navy. And, it's just, the structure of the military was there. But, the soul was just, I was just lost. And while I was away, though, a friend back home had a born-again experience. And she was actually the girlfriend of the young man that I joined the Navy with. And I knew her, and I thought, well, this is going to be different. She's born again now, and her life wasn't too much different from mine as a teenager. So when I got back from the Philippines, I was very interested to hear what she had to say. And, I was Catholic, and she came with a couple friends bringing the gospel with me. And I said, well, I got a crucifix on. I don't need the gospel, or, I'll smoke less, I'll cuss less. I mean, that was my catechesis. I mean, I didn't know any more than that. And they invited me to a passion play at this large Baptist church in North Houston. And I agreed to go on one condition, that after this, you shut up about Jesus. I don't want to hear anymore. Well, as you might expect, things turned out a little bit differently. And I went to this passion play. I was so ignorant, Keith, that you know, they're portraying Jesus doing the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm asking people, who's that? I didn't even know who it was. And then they did the crucifixion scene, and people around me are weeping, and I'm cynical, and you know, and I'm just not a very sharp guy in some ways as a 22-year-old. And I'm like, why are these people weeping? This is really weird. But then they did the resurrection scene and something happened. And I knew at that moment that Jesus was alive and that I was undone. Wow. That I feared for where I was at in my life. And that night, April 30th, 1989, I gave my life to Christ. And within 2 months, I had forsaken the Catholic Church. I was given a book that many of your listeners will be very familiar with, unfortunately, and that's Lorraine Bettner's book, Roman Catholicism, you know, the anti-Catholic Bible. But I didn't know any better. I was given this book by the pastor of this church, and it turned me fiercely anti-Catholic. Yeah. And I guess, you know, along came that, behind that came the Jack Chick tracts and some other books, like I believe his name is James McCarthy. I still have a couple books on the shelf back here, a little more ironic than Lorraine Bettner, but still, you know, the typical anti-Catholicism. And I grew very bitter against the church, and never thought that there'd be a day when I would go back. I developed a desire to be a pastor during this time. It was a very fruitful time in my life. I met my wife in 1992. I actually met my wife in Galveston on a loosely organized mission trip. I walked in. I'd never met her before. I walked into this church where these groups of friends were meeting to go evangelize on the beach over spring break. Walked in. I saw my wife. I walked out, told my friend, I'm going to marry her. Well, I mean, not, I mean, I guess the litany of humility hadn't come into my life at, you know, at this point, but I actually married her, and I married her 70 days later. Wow. So we didn't waste any time. We had, we now have five children, and we had our children, you know, we had five children in 6 years. So we had them in pretty rapid succession. It's great. They're all grown now. And, we just love our kids and love the blessing that they've been in their lives. So I also, I pastored a church during this period. This is like the late 90s. But in pastoring a church, I realized that I didn't really have a good grounding for my faith. And I kind of developed this cleavage between faith and reason. It's what I started calling having a midair fortress, where I knew how to explain the Bible. I knew how to work my way through some theology, but I didn't know if any of it was true. I had an experience that I knew what had happened to but I didn't really know whether it corresponded to reality. And so I got to where I didn't even want to share the gospel because I didn't have answers. I'd go to pastors. They'd say, just believe more. Or, you know, you must have a moral problem. And I was sharp enough to respond that, well, I know I have a moral problem. I mean, that's part of the reason why I knew I needed Christ. My question is, was there one angel or two at the tomb? I mean, things like that I couldn't answer. Friend of mine tells me about Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. I flew out and met with Dr. Geisler. I'd never met him before. I'm not sure if I'd read any of his books at that point, and was just super impressed with his knowledge, his welcome. He was just very, very, the hospitality that he showed us was just second to none. And within a couple months, my wife and I moved our five children out to Charlotte, and we began there in 2001. Now, Doug would have started, I believe, in the late 90s, because he graduated. I want to say Doug was like another level above. Like he was Dr. Geisler's assistant. Like all these books I have of Dr. Geisler says thanks to Doug Beaumont for all the, you know, so. He's another level, and he was also, I graduated in 2005, and I think he might have been a part of the class of 2002. Obviously, he could correct me on that, but that class has probably not been surpassed to this day for its level of scholarship. But while I was at seminary, Keith, there was two classes that just made a huge impact in my life. And it's important for people to know that, you know, this is an evangelical seminary that's saturated with Thomism. So you're going to learn, you're going to have St. Thomas Aquinas and the Neo-Thomists, guys like Etienne Gilson and Garrigou Lagrange and Joseph Owen and more contemporary Thomists. You're just going to be force-fed that. And, you know, the first time I heard the word metaphysics, I thought that was the crystal, section in Barnes & Noble. I didn't know what metaphysics was. It frightened me. But I soon learned that things like logic and how to defend the reality of truth and the existence of God. And what Dr. Geisler did for me, and to my dying day, I will always thank him for this. He put that midair fortress back on solid ground. I had a foundation now. I had a resting place for my understanding of the Christian faith. And so he really put me back in service. I was ready to go back out and serve again. And while I was there, we had a summer class on ethics, and our visiting professor was Dr. Francis Beckwith. And I love the class. I love the approach. I love the topics we learned, you know, pro-life issues particularly and some others, but I was very much excited to learn pro-life arguments that I could really take and use. And turns out at that time that Dr. Beckwith had gotten an appointment at Baylor University. I wanted to go back to Texas. When I graduated, I applied for Baylor and got in. And so while I was there, I kind of learned that I was not really a scholar and not really wanting to pursue the academic life. I was a pastor at heart. That's what I wanted to do. But let me tell you, Keith, SES trained me well, maybe too well in some areas, because, you know, in a PhD program, this was a PhD program that I converted to a master's later, but you have these graduate seminars where you sit around and you kind of challenge each other when they write a research paper. And every time it got around to me, I was like, you're self-refuting. Your argument is self-referentially incoherent. This, you know, and eventually to where there was another student in one of my seminars. It's, you know, that commented one day on some papers, well, we wouldn't know these things because we didn't go to Southern Evangelical Seminary, just mocking me in front of everybody. I actually kind of thought that was kind of fun. Ironically, that guy was Mr. Southern Baptist at the time, and he's now Catholic. And so, so Baylor was a great time. Now, so as you know, Dr. Beckwith was the president of the Evangelical Theological Society. So he was president-elect in 2006. And then in 2007, they become the president. And in the course before ETS met in the fall, I think it was in April of 2007, all of a sudden, Dr. Beckwith makes the announcement that he's reverting to Catholicism. And I thought, what is going on here? And it was, you know, it was kind of strange time. But, you know, he was a Thomist. He always seemed to argue on the basis of, like, he'd pull out a papal encyclical. He'd refer to this pope or that pope. So he was a natural law guy. So it made sense. And he was raised Catholic. And once he began to do as most reverts and converts do, they begin to really read the early church fathers and things. So he came back to the Catholic Church. I left Baylor and was able to fulfill my dream in 2009 of becoming a full-time pastor. And I could not have been just more excited. The church was a little bit out of my comfort zone. It was actually a church with Plymouth Brethren roots. And I've never had any Plymouth Brethren in my body at all. But, you know, being kind of a generic Bible church is what they were trying to become. And, you know, the theology matched pretty well. Some of the practices I had to grow accustomed to, but I was more than happy to do what I needed to do to be their pastor. And so 2009, my family moved back to the Houston area. I started pastoring the church, loved it. I just was at home. I was able to take the theology and the philosophy and the apologetics and weave it through the scriptures and in sermons, but meet people where they're at. I wasn't an academic. I wasn't a scholar, but I was a pastor and I loved to teach the youth. I loved to ground them in apologetics. So it was a great time for about 5 or 6 years. Things went very well. And then we started having some conflict in the church, and it turns out that it was more than just conflict. It turns out that there was some very deep corruption in the leadership of the church. And once I kind of found out more of what was going on, there's no way in good conscience I could stand idly by or continue to minister under those circumstances. So I dragged on for about 6 months trying to, to deal with it properly. And instead they chose to deal with me and they excommunicated me from the church.
Wow.
And the church had grown like almost doubled while I was there. And so This whole scandalized the church. And so about a third of the church left and formed a new church, which I became a very reluctant pastor of. I don't like being the pastor of a church split. It's just a lot of hurt feelings. And I actually went to Dr. Geisler. And if you know Dr. Richard Land, if any of your listeners know Dr. Richard Land, it was a very prominent Southern Baptist. And they had both had a big role in my life. And I went to them and I said, look, this is what's happening. What should I do? And they contradicted each other. Dr. Geisler told me, this will never work. You got to go. Dr. Land told me, you're responsible to those people. You got to stay. And they were both right in many ways. So I stayed until, for about a year and a half. And then, we thought we were going to do church right. We set it up on a 9 marks model. We've got it all figured out now, and it didn't work out very well. So about 18 months in, I knew I needed to resign. And so I was 50 years old. This is 2017. If your listeners remember Hurricane Harvey in Houston, it's during that time. I was 50 years old. I was without a job. I could not go into ministry anymore. You can't really go to the next church and say, okay, I want to apply to be your pastor. Well, tell me about your last two churches. Well, let me tell you, that's not, you can't do that. So I just knew it was time. And it had been very hard on my family. My kids went through this with us and, it was just hard on them, hard on my wife. And so I started over. I didn't know what I was going to do. Ironically, it was a Catholic author, Jay Richards, that helped me just mentally, psychologically go back into the business world. And I read his book. I think it's called God, Greed, and Money. And it just helped me go back into my old job. Actually, God planted me right back in my job I had before, which I still have now. It was humiliating at the time because I thought I'm this big pastor and I was starting over. And so these are what I would describe years of wandering in wilderness for my wife and I. We went from 2017 to 2023. We went to 15 different churches. We couldn't go to any church in our area because people knew us. Or they knew our kids. Yeah. And they thought they knew something about what had happened. So there's all the whisperings that started. We lived at the time on the southwest side of Houston. We would go to the north side of Houston to go to a church to try to just find a place to worship without running into somebody we knew. And invariably, we would run into somebody that we knew. 15 different churches, I think 6 or 7 different denominations. Of course, Baptist, non-denominational. We went to a rock and roll Lutheran church. We went to a Orthodox Presbyterian church. We went to an Eastern Orthodox church. I can't even remember what else, but I can tell you one thing I was not interested in trying, and that was a Catholic church. Because even though Dr. Geisler had taught me, He'd kind of sanded off that anti-Catholicism that I had built up from Lorraine Bettner and others, because he has an appreciation for much of Catholicism, but he also has an approach that makes you think that he's resolved the differences between Catholics and evangelicals in such a way that I could never bridge that. He's fair-minded. He's looked into it, and he says you can't go there because of these. So I would say, I'd be Catholic if not for these 7 things, because I did respect the Catholic Church for a number of things, and we all know what those 7 things are. It's the same 7 things for everybody. So I was never going to go to a Catholic church, or so I thought. So let me fast forward to March 18th of last year, because this is where things really changed for my wife and I. One day we were, we live on the northwest side of Houston now, and one day we had to run some errands very close to my parents' old church. And so I said, you know, why don't we just go there out of nostalgia? Let's just go in there. I showed my wife like the neighborhood I used to live in, and we'd drive by houses in the neighborhood. I said, yeah, that kid's parent was a drunk, and that kid's parent was this, and this is where I wrecked one car, and this is where I used to vandalize houses. And, you know, it was just a nostalgia trip.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of the nostalgia was like, you did all that? Like, you were not a good kid. It was not a good kid. But it was kind of fun. And we said, well, let's just stop in at the 5 p.m. Mass and just, what do we have to lose? But I was not looking at Catholicism. It was pure nostalgia. So we walk into the church and something happened at that Mass. And it was haunting to us. There was just a haunting presence of God. It was during Lent. This is the church I grew up in that was hippie Catholicism. It was felt banners and tambourines, and it was not that anymore. There was Latin. There was a solemn tone to it. I heard more scripture in that one Mass than I'd heard in the last 6 months of my Baptist church. I mean, I'm a little facetious, but you get the, just the readings, everything about it. It haunted us, and it compelled us. At the same time, they mentioned, the act of contrition. Therefore, we ask Blessed Mary, ever Virgin. Whoa, what's Mary got to do with this? The whole Mass is a sacrifice. The priest up there with doing his cooking show, and I'm, of course, this is blasphemous to me as a Protestant, you know, this whole idea of re-sacrificing Jesus. And then they end with this prayer to St. Michael. I'm like, and I'm just offended by all those things. But at the same time, I'm strangely compelled by what's going on. So we just started on this path. 6 days later, we went to the Center for Thomistic Studies because we heard that Ed Fazer was giving a talk there. We get down there and Ed Fazer's had to cancel because he was sick. And so we run into a man by the name of Brian Carl, who's the director of the Institute, or I don't know if that's his exact role, but he's got an administrative role there as well as teaching. And he starts telling me how he knows this guy named Jason Reed. I'm like, you know Jason Reed? And do you know Jason?
No, I've not met him, but I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
From SES. Yeah. I'm like, this is really weird. This is really strange. So just, I mean, I didn't factor in a whole lot, but it was just kind of one of those weird things. The next day we go to Mass again at Prince of Peace. This is the church on the north side of Houston. My wife and I get there early, and they ask us to bring the offering up front. This is what, as a kid, I called halftime. Yeah. It's all it was halftime. I was like, phew, this thing is almost over. And we refused to do it. We said, we're not Catholic. I said, oh, that's okay. You can still do that. My wife didn't want to be anywhere near a priest. And I was scared to go down there. So we said, we're not doing this. We can't do this. And, you know, to this day, I'm kind of feel a little ashamed that we refused to bring down the gifts, you know, but we just weren't ready for that. Yeah. So then, you know, I think it was the next day that we started buying books. We just had to start learning. And so I went to an author that I completely trusted as an apologist, and I figured he would give me a good flavor for Catholicism and be a very familiar name, Peter Kreeft. And so I read just a little book of his called 40 Reasons That I'm Catholic. Didn't do anything for me because he kind of, it wasn't the book for me. Let's just put it that way. And then I picked up this book by this guy I'd never heard of named Trent Horn. And I'd never heard of him. And his book, Why We're Catholic.
Yeah.
And it didn't really do much for me because it really wasn't what I needed. In fact, well, later on, I read his case for Catholicism, and that's what I needed. But the first two books I read just were like, that's not really doing it for me, but I've got to know. So we just started buying books. And I think within a few weeks, we had probably bought like 75 books and read half of them. We basically took it on as a full-time, a second full-time job, both my wife and I. And we kind of teamed up because things that interested and concerned her, she would study.
The
Marian doctrines. I mean, she read Tim Staples before I read them, and she had questions about the Eucharist and stuff, and I had questions about other things. And so we worked together in our day job from home. And so it was just like this conversation we would have during work. And then we were reading all the time. And so we came upon some really, really key moments. One of them being that March 18th day, but then Keith, you can understand this. Like, so I was baptized as Catholic. So you know what the church teaches about baptism, but none of that seemed true in my life. None of it was evident in my life at all. I mean, there was no sign of spiritual life at all until I went to that Baptist church. And so I always said, well, that's the moment I was born again. That was my conversion experience. That's the moment I met Christ. And then I'm reading the catechism. And the catechism is telling me something different about baptism. It's telling me something different about those sacraments of initiation. You know, I always thought it was funny, the confirmation, how it strengthens the, your relationship with the Holy Spirit. I know I'm misquoting it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you see my life after confirmation? None of that was true or didn't, obviously it didn't pan out in my life till later.
Yeah.
I needed somehow to put a narrative together where I could understand this is what the church teaches, but this is what seemed to happen in my life. I need a narrative, and I didn't know how to put it together. And we go to Holy Week was interesting for us. We went to church 5 times during Holy Week. We went to our Baptist church on Thursday for a Maundy Thursday service. So we thought it would be really solemn, kind of different from what they normally do. And instead it was a rock band. The campus pastor, they had communion, which they didn't do very often. And the campus pastor invited us up to the bistro table. I kid you not, he referred to it as a bistro table to get our cracker and juice. And Friday we went to a very distinguished PCA church here in town. Pretty much every Reformed scholar that you've ever heard of has come through this church. So it's very distinguished. It was a beautiful service. I mean, it was saturated with scripture, but something was missing. Saturday, last Easter, we got this bright idea. We were going to go to the Easter Vigil. We had no idea what an Easter Vigil was. And 4.5 hours later, we knew what an Easter Vigil was. And so it was just a packed in weekend. We went back to the Baptist church for 8 a.m. service there and then raced back to the north side of town to go to 11 o'clock mass. And this is where I had just this other moment where they had a visiting priest and said mass. And then after mass, like kind of when the announcements were done, he just said, I've got a few more comments I'd like to make. And he said, I think he was basing it on Pope Francis's Easter Vigil homily. He said, you need to have your Galilee moment. When Jesus was raised from the dead and he said, I will meet you in Galilee. And he said, you need to have your Galilee moment where you meet the risen Lord and you have a life changing encounter with the risen Lord. And some of you even know the very day that happened. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's talking to me.
Yeah.
God has answered my prayer. And after mass, I ran up to this priest and I practically tackled him. Said April 30th, 1989. I know him. And to this day, he's been a spiritual director for me. And he's continued to guide me in many ways. And so God answered that prayer for me. 3 days later, we go to this. It's like a youth ministry at the church there, Prince of Peace. They called it Elevate. And it's an adoration service. Keith, I didn't know what an adoration service was.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea what adoration was. And so they, it's really not just youth. There was a lot of people our age there. And they're singing like, What a Beautiful Name. They're singing contemporary evangelical songs. I thought, that's kind of weird, but it's kind of cool too, because it's familiar.
Yeah.
But they're singing them in a very Catholic kind of way. And then they had a guy came out. He was the youth director. He gave this fiery exhortation. I told him later, I said, if you had been here when I was 16, I might never have left. Because this is a different world than I grew up in as far as this church goes. And then And then they brought out the monstrance. And I'm telling you, my wife is having a religious experience because she's been reading Brant Petrie's book, yes, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, and she's seeing it.
Amazing.
Yeah. Keith, you know what I'm seeing at this moment? The eye of Sauron is all I can see. I said, I'm staring at, this is what they warned me about. This is what all my Protestants have been telling me not to go into. I couldn't get over seeing this, this monstrance on this pole. I mean, I didn't know how to describe it. I was just really taken aback by it. So the very next day I said, you know what, I better read that Brant Petrie book. And so at this time, you know, I was reading, I wish I could get back to this, but I was reading usually a book in a day or two, just devouring books. You've been there. And, you know, like you've mentioned staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning when on YouTube, we were doing things like that. So I picked up Brant Petrie's book and was floored. I didn't even know Catholics knew the Bible.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that they could make a case from the Bible. And I'm like, this is incredible. He's tying in all these themes from the Old Testament and showing how they converge in Christ. And I'm just really blown away by this, but stumbling over John chapter 6, as you know, as many evangelicals would, I thought that John 6:63 is the key that locks the door to Catholicism. I mean, the words I've spoken to you are spirit and life. The flesh profits nothing. It's just a metaphor. All he's saying in a very graphic way is you got to believe in me. But I started to believe there was more to it than that. I'd seen enough in reading the catechism and other Catholics that they're starting to make too much sense. And there's more to that. And so I really wrestled with it. But one thing that I always had this fascination with the wilderness generation. And in Brant Petrie's chapter on the, you know, John 6 about the new Moses leading a new Exodus, what food would he give for the people on the journey? And so, of course, the answer there, I am the bread of life. You got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. But I'm still just have this mental block here. Well, the following Sunday, we decided to go to a different Catholic church because I wanted to make sure I wasn't just on some nostalgia trip. I wasn't just going back to my parents' old church to kind of trying to pick up some pieces from my past or something. I said, I need to know if I'm connecting to the Catholic church or just something in my past. And so we went to a different church and I realized right off the bat that this is not nostalgia anymore. I am seeing something in the Catholic big C church that I wasn't seeing before. And then we weren't taking communion, obviously, at this point. I wouldn't even go up front. I wouldn't even do the arm cross thing. I was afraid to even go down. So I'm just sitting up in this. This is a church that's more of a auditorium style. And so you could sit back and see everything that's going on. And when people are going down to receive communion, I all of a sudden saw it. This is God feeding his people.
Yeah.
This is the Exodus. And Jesus is leading us to a new Jerusalem and he's feeding us on the way. And it just made sense to me. And I think from that point, this was April 16th of last year. I said my entire reversion experience basically was compressed into 34 days. From the time we first went to Mass till I knew enough to trust the church, and I knew I had come to that place secure enough to where I was willing to call my dad and tell him, because I wasn't going to tell my dad until I knew. That was 34 days. The day before I called my dad, though, I reached out to Doug Beaumont, and I talked to Doug, and I was, you know, this was an interesting conversation because we hadn't talked in a while, and I'd watched his journey home. And I'd watched Frank Beckwith and kind of binge watched a lot of Marcus Grody there for a while. So I talked to Doug and everything's going great. He's explaining all these things to me. I got all kinds of questions. And then he says, oh, so you were baptized Catholic and your wife wasn't? Oh, your marriage is invalid.
No doubt.
And we're like, I thought, whoa, we've been married for 31 years. I mean, we've got 5 grown kids. We've got a grandkid. We've been faithful to each other. What do you mean our marriage is invalid? And of course, you know, he's talking about canon law. He's talking about sacramentally, we needed to have our marriage brought into the Catholic Church. So, Doug, if you watch this show, you almost derailed the whole thing because it set us into a panic. I mean, I was on the phone with Frank Beckwith. I said, Frank, what do I do? By this time, I was allowed to call him Frank. what do I do? I'm calling my dad. I'm calling other people. I called a local priest trying to get some. I met with another priest. I'm like, what do I do? Well, it was very emotionally upsetting to my wife, of course. I mean, because that was just a stab in the heart. And so, eventually we've learned what had to be done. And my dad's priest walked us through it. And all's well that ends well. So that by July, my wife was received into the church, and our marriage was validated. And then I received the sacrament of reconciliation on July 29th. So it was a compressed journey, and we had to discover a lot of things. I had to overcome all those. I had to relearn history. I had to tackle all those offensive doctrines, the papacy, purgatory, Mary. Actually, purgatory never really bothered me much. It was more justification, and it was sola scriptura. And those were really the biggies for me. Maybe the papacy a little bit, although that didn't bother me. Once I saw that it didn't just depend on Matthew 16, that there was a lot more to it than that. It's not like the evangelicals can say, we've got a great idea for unity over here if you just listen to us. I mean, that hadn't worked out for 500 years. So we had to do all the same work, but it was really, it was really discovering the Eucharist. Where else can we go? Like Peter said, where else can we go to receive that gift, incredible, beautiful gift where God wants to be that close to us and wants to just, feed us like he does in the Eucharist. So I've been rattling for a long time. I don't know if you probably should interject here and let me drink some water. And I hope that kind of made sense. It was a lot in a short journey for us, but we're very excited now. And I actually found myself on the pastoral council of our local church. I mean, I'm the most unworthy person to be on that council. And I'm now on a pastoral council of a Catholic church, which is just, God has a wonderful sense of humor. So we'll see how that goes. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. Putting you right to work. I love that. Using your gifts. What a fantastic journey. Like, that is a really amazing, interesting story. I do have a lot of questions for you. Maybe we'll just start at the Eucharist. That's the last thing you kind of mentioned just now. And I wonder, for you, you were a pastor doing that work of running a church at one point. You have experienced the evangelical church for decades. When you would do communion or partake in communion, you mentioned that one church where there was the bistro table. I think for me, the time that I realized that I was more Catholic than evangelical was when I was at visiting a family friend's church or something, I think it was, and the pastor changed the words from Corinthians, to say, this is, Christ said, this is like my body. Yeah. I went, wait a minute, that's not what the scripture says. Jesus never said, like my body. He said, my body. And if we have to add the word like to the words of scripture, we're changing scripture to fit our theology. And that for me was kind of a turning point in my belief system when I realized that I was more Catholic than evangelical. But you talked about that bistro kind of experience. I wonder, through all that time in that 30-something years as an evangelical, what was communion like for you? Like, what did you think you were doing, or did it feel like you were doing at that time compared to, coming home to the Eucharist?
I think it's two things. Now I should say, okay, so for 6 years, give or take, or 6.5 years, I was a pastor of a church that had Plymouth Brethren roots.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about Plymouth Brethrenism, they have a special, they call it a meeting. They have a special meeting every Sunday they call the breaking of bread service. It's like nothing you've ever really experienced before, because it's kind of open mic time. Any of the men can say, let's sing this hymn. Let's sing this song, and or go up to the mic and share a thought. And then at the end, they pass around a basket of Hawaiian bread, literally. And then, the little juice cups, and you take communion, but you do it every Sunday. And it's a very integral part of what it means to be Plymouth Brethren. Yeah. Of course, again, I was not Plymouth Brethren, but I was just the pastor of a church. And I, to me, it was like being all things to all people. adopt those practices that I didn't think were unbiblical. And it was like, okay, I mean, you just treating communion a slightly different way than I would as a Baptist. But for the rest of my 28 years as an evangelical, whenever we did communion, which could be weekly, well, probably not, it could be monthly or quarterly, it was really just a special time to remember Jesus and introspection.
In
some churches, the introspection part of it was, well, it ran the gamut. It could be a real hyper puritanical type introspection that, you know, left you wondering if you're even saved, or it could be, you know, very, very superficial, but basically just, you know, we haven't really thought about what Jesus did on the cross for us for 3 months. So we're going to do that. You know, it's that time of the year again, the first Sunday of April or whatever. And we're going to take communion. It was taken very seriously. But of course, we were adamant because we knew that Jesus only meant this metaphorically. He only meant this as a symbol. He, just like baptism, we were adamant about that. And so, you know, if you don't drink all the juice, you just throw in the trash. You don't, you know, the breadcrumbs on the floor, it's just bread. That's all it is. Doesn't mean you don't take it seriously. It doesn't mean you're not trying to honor God, but you're just misinformed about what it is that really should be going on there. Of course, it has to be that way because you cannot have the Eucharist without a consecrated priesthood, and you cannot have a consecrated priesthood without apostolic succession. So if you're divorced from that stream, then you can't have a Eucharist. I mean, you can have some kind of memorial service, but you can't consecrate the bread and the wine unless you're a validly ordained priest. And so, you know, it's taken seriously, but the meaning of it is just, it's not the same. It's not even close to the same. In fact, many times I can't remember ever weeping taking Hawaiian bread and grape juice. But I can't tell you how many times, and I'm not trying to be, you know, but can't tell you how many times in just the last year. Well, I was able to start receiving communion back in last July. Can't tell you how many times that it's left me weeping, or I'm actually going down in front and the priest must think, wow, he must've just repented of some serious sins. You know, I've got tears. Yeah. It's not it. They're tears of regret. For years, I didn't raise my kids in the Catholic Church, and I regret that. I mean, I know I can't go back and undo that, although I've shared it with them, but there's so many things they missed. And I know I would have been a better dad. I have no doubt about that. But there's just so many ways in which they missed out on just the Catholic life is just beautiful. It's amazing. It just consumes, if you live it right, it consumes every day. Consumes the hours of the days. You just get immersed in it. We've had three consecutive saint days, right? St. Patrick, St. Cyril yesterday, St. Joseph today. I got my St. Joseph here. my beautiful wife gave this to me today. Just so much beauty that they missed. Sometimes it was tears of regret, and sometimes it was just tears of just, God, you love me so much. And you brought me back to home, and I know I'm home. And that's one thing you hear. You don't hear, oh my gosh, you left us for 34 years and spent so much of that time preaching against us, and now you come. No, what you hear is, welcome home, welcome home, welcome home. And I tell you, every time I hear that, I get a little bit choked up. To answer your question a little bit about the Eucharist.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
We would never use that word.
Yeah.
We would never use that word.
Yeah.
It was just communion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of two things, and the first is that weeping. I can remember a very good friend of mine, actually I had him on the show recently, Joe Goodwin, to tell his story. And he was, for me, a kind of a mentor. He was the other guy who was being converted by the same pastor who we had in common, who I was chatting with him. He was chatting with him. We both became Catholic. The pastor still, you know, we pray for him daily. He's not Catholic yet, but he caused both of our conversions separately. Yeah. And when I met Joe, we became very good friends. And he was Catholic ahead of me, so I was still in the process of discerning the Catholic Church. And I went to Mass a few times with a men's group, and he was part of this group. And I can remember I didn't receive the Eucharist, but they did, and I was kind of watching, like you say, in the back. And he went up, he received the Eucharist, And he went off to the side, to a little side chapel in this old, like, beautiful downtown church, the city where we were living, gorgeous, like, 1885 church, beautiful, to the side altar, and kneeled and began to weep. And that, for me, was like, what does he have? Like, what just happened? Because I wasn't, you know, I was intrigued. I was on the journey. That's I wasn't there yet. And I went, what does he have that I don't have? Like, what is he getting out of this that's causing him to fall to his knees and to weep and just to be overcome with that, right? And that ties in for me, too, with the idea of the introspection you talked about in communion, right? And that I was, for a while, part of a charismatic church, right? And so communion for us was, okay, communion is coming this weekend. This is the communion Sunday. So before communion, we have this great big charismatic kind of whoop up the emotion time, right, Gerard? where the point was not that, like, intellectual kind of conviction, like introspection, but hey, you better right now have a Holy Spirit experience, because if you don't, are you really worthy to receive? I shouldn't say receive, that was the wrong idea. I wasn't receiving anything, but are you worthy to participate in communion, right? So we are taking that idea of Paul, of St. Paul, saying you have to really discern whether, you know, you have to really understand what you're doing here. And of course, as Catholic, that makes total different sense. Discerning the body of Christ is a different thing than we ever did, right? Despite reading those words and trying to understand that, right? The idea that you shouldn't take communion unworthily, that was our idea as charismatics. Yeah. Well, if I'm worthy to take communion, I really need to have this experience of God right now before I do that. It was this strange, and that, of course, is totally foreign to the Catholic view of that, right? Where the Eucharist is this sacrifice, this once and for all sacrifice represented, like Brant Petrie so eloquently explains in his books, right? We're taking part in that, in the crucifixion, in the Last Supper, being present at that whole experience. And what I love about that, in contrast, is that I cannot have to whoop up myself into a emotional frenzy. I don't need to have to totally feel like, yes, I am ready and worthy to receive this. And if I'm not, it means nothing because it's just symbolic. It's tangible grace, whether I fully understand that and fully, like, want it in that moment, or if I'm in a spiritual funk and just going to mass because I know I need to go, I don't want to be there, the kids are screaming, I'm exhausted, right? You know, my pants are torn, I'm like, my hair's a mess, right? I still receive that same grace from the Eucharist, whether I am emotionally whooped up or intellectually engaged or not, which I think is so beautiful about the Catholic faith. Those sacraments work whether we, you know, whoop ourselves up into them or even fully understand them and grasp the exact thing happening there, or even want to be there necessarily, right?
Let me ask you this. So did it kind of trip you out a little bit when you thought of how Gnostic your former evangelical faith is? Yeah. Not that it's fully Gnostic, but it does... You know, the Catholic faith brings the body and soul in true union in worship.
Yeah.
So we have, I mean, obviously the Eucharist is the source and summit. It's top on that list. But there's so many other ways in which, you know, you think about Christopher West's Theology of the Body. You just think about there's purpose in the beauty, in the incense, in every little detail. And I've learned so much of this from my wife, because she recognizes, like, he's wearing different color vestments. There's only two candles lit, not six candles. She'll notice all this stuff, and it all has a purpose, because the it involves the body, obviously the soul is the essence of it, but the body is involved. And it kind of frightened me a little bit when I realized, wow, when the early, like, guys like Saint Ignatius of Antioch, he would have thought I was a Gnostic.
Yeah.
I would have been one of the guys he was warning other people about. And I saw so many ways in which there's, like, this subtle Gnosticism that runs through evangelicalism that is discarded and brought into, it's just the body and soul is brought into perfect union in the Catholic faith. Did you kind of notice that same thing?
Yeah. And it was certainly intriguing. And I mean, I went from a church in early university that was a Pentecostal church that was completely bare, you know, concrete walls across off to the side. Yeah. Right now, now that church, Gerard, is full of smoke machines and spotlights and
gotta have smoke machines.
Right. Yeah. It's quite different than it was, you know, 25 years ago or something. But, you know, back then that it was just so bare and empty. Now you will find Catholic churches like that too. My friend Robert, who's from the same hometown I was, will say, well, the Catholic churches in that town too are also, pretty terrible. But going from that stripped down barren place to my first Catholic experience was in this church built in like 1835 in a little town where we lived that was just beautiful, and the ceiling is painted like a fresco, and like there's there's statues everywhere, and they're placed the candles with all electric candles, which is really lame and not even allowed by canon law. I don't think I don't think it's even actually legitimately allowed electric candles, but you know that disparity was striking, right? And I think too, I had Marcus Gerdai on the show years ago, and something he said that has always stuck with me is that, you know, the most devout Catholic practicing their faith to the fullest extent will look like a crazy pagan to an evangelical, right? Because they're kneeling, right?
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're in a service that has incense, right? And they have rosary beads. They have a scapular on or something, right? Like, they're praying these rote prayers from a prayer book, like, you know, three, four, or five times a day. Yeah. They're celebrating saints' feasts and talking about relics and these kind of things.
Yeah.
Like, that looks very, very foreign, very pagan to the evangelical, as used to that stripped-down kind of Bible-only kind of Christianity, stripped of those things, kind of Gnostic, right? But you look at the early church fathers, gosh, there's relics from a very, very early date, right? There's the mass that looks and sounds like the mass we have now from a very early date, right? There's prayers to the saints, there's veneration of relics, there's all these things that gosh, I thought were crazy pagan, and I would have seen that super uber Catholic and thought that guy is just a crazy, that's all totally wrong. Yeah. But it's right there in the guys that learned from the apostles.
Yeah. You've had a couple guests on recently, Joe Heschmeyer and Rod Bennett. And they, I mean, I watch Shameless Popery all the time and I read everything these guys put out. Joe Heschmeyer's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church I did a list of my, the five books that had the most impact on me, on my reversion, and his book made number four. Could have made three, but Brant Petrie was ahead of him. Brant Petrie could have made two, but Francis de Sales was ahead of him.
Yes.
And Francis de Sales could have made one, but the Catechism gets number one. But
fair enough.
You've had a couple guests on, Rod Bennett and Joe Heschmeyer, that they introduced me to the early church. And, you know, like I mentioned, St. Ignatius of Antioch, I read him and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm one of the guys he would have warned against.
Yes. Yes.
But the one that blew my mind was Justin Martyr. Yeah. When I read Justin Martyr describe the liturgy, I mean, it's an outline form, but the liturgy he describes in 155 AD that looks almost exactly like the liturgy that you know, at least in the Latin rite, the churches that it looks very much like the Novus Ordo.
Yeah.
The liturgy of the word, a liturgy of the Eucharist, and all the things in, you know, the fill in the gap there. I saw that and I thought, wait a minute. I was kind of under the impression that they had invented this sometime in the Middle Ages, or maybe you know, after the Reformation or something. And here's the thing. Justin Martyr is not saying, hey guys, I've got an idea about the way we should do things. No, he's saying we received this, and he's simply describing, as he writing to Emperor Trajan, I can't remember who he was writing to, but he's simply describing what's already established practice.
Yeah.
In 155, I thought this is not what I thought about. This is just not what I thought. And so, I mean, I'm very, very typical in the, you know, those that, you know, read the early church fathers, and it's a dangerous thing to do if you intend to stay Protestant. You're going to have to carefully curate that list.
Yeah.
Because if you read too much, you're going to say, wow, my church would not have been recognized. We you know, baptism wasn't just a symbol. You know, the Eucharist wasn't just a quarterly thing that you did with a piece of bread. You know, they weren't just, you know, a group of elders. They had a hierarchy and they had a liturgy. It wasn't just some free form thing with smoke machines and a band. It wouldn't look like any church I'd ever been a part of. And I think it's Steve Ray in the back of that Rod Bennett book that says, you know, we can't claim to be followers of Christ if we reject everything that, you know, that the disciples of Jesus did. I mean, we say, well, they got the Trinity right, they got Christology right, they got the canon of the New Testament right, but then they left the back door open to all these other things. But yet we still trust them, you know, even though they were full of paganism and superstition and had this, I think, Joe Heschmeyer's phrase, the creeping heresy. But yet they got all the really big things right. It's just this inconsistency. And when you begin to see, no, these guys were amazing. And the Christianity of the early church didn't look anything like what I had been a part of. I mean, of course, we had the, you know, some of the core doctrinal things, but the things we considered essentials left out some pretty important things that the early church considered essentials. And once you kind of start seeing that, it's like, I can't say that I know better than these guys.
Yeah.
That I'm somehow closer to Christ because, well, I've got the whole Bible. I've got logos on my computer. So obviously I know better than they know. I mean, so that was revolutionary for me to see that early church. So you've had some guests on there that have had a huge impact on my life. And just grateful for them and grateful for you to keep getting these guys, keep getting them exposed to more and more people. Not that Rod Bennett probably needs any more, but I know he likes being on your show, and I know you like having him on your show. You guys have a good time together.
He's a wonderful guy. Those are some great guests you've named, and I appreciate your kind words, and I'm sure they do too. You mentioned Ignatius of Antioch, and that for me was what sealed John 6 for me, right?
Yeah.
You'd read John 6, and like you said, you'd go, well, look, it sounds literal. But then he says the flesh, you know, in this last part there that is kind of spirit, and it seems like you could probably maybe that cancels out the rest, right? No. But then you read early church father like Ignatius of Antioch, who, and I got in trouble for saying this before in a video. I got some pushback from some people who are like, are you saying we're not Christian? Like, this isn't right. But, yeah. Well, I'm not saying it, right? Ignatius of Antioch, right? Yeah. Early church father is saying the way, you know, one of the ways you know who the non-Christians are is those are the guys who deny that the Eucharist communion, right, is the actual flesh of Jesus that hung and suffered on the cross.
Yeah.
Like that is unequivocally, you know, talking about Jesus being actually present in the Eucharist, which of course I would not have believed whatsoever as an evangelical, right? Yeah. Not spiritually present, not present in some kind of way that you feel like he's there and you alone in your church can kind of feel that. I know there'd been some kind of Protestant pushback saying, well, I can kind of believe in the real presence. Well, that is really the flesh of Christ in some way, right? And being part of a church that doesn't believe that wholesale, right? Ignatius of Antioch, who's one of the very early church fathers who learned from the apostles, right? Taught by the apostles, is saying this is how you know who the Christians are.
Yeah.
And I go, wait a minute, then I'm not a Christian according to somebody who learned from the apostles. Yeah. Like, what does that mean for me? That was terribly shocking. I know, Dr. John Bergsma, one of the great guys who I love to have on this show, fantastic, you know, a convert, 10 years a pastor, encountered that in the church fathers and went, wait a minute, what do I do with this? He went and did a PhD to try and figure it out, right?
Yeah.
In Bible and scripture. But that was so convicting for me as I read that. And I go, well, what do I make of that? That's quite clear that totally. I don't believe that. My church doesn't believe that. And even if I personally believe that, if my denomination, if my church doesn't practice that, well, then I don't fit there in that church anymore. And I got to go find a church that practices that. And where does that take me, right?
Yeah, like I said, when I read Ignatius, I was like, oh my, I mean, he literally would have been warning Christians about me, and that is shocking. Like you said, it's quite shocking. I've kind of transitioned a little bit now to where I've gone from, obviously, it's only been a year for me, but my wife and I've come a long way in that year. And so it's no longer so much as like trying to undo a Protestant mind and get into a Catholic mind. Now I'm looking around at evangelicals and Protestants and saying, why wouldn't you be Catholic?
Yeah.
Like literally why wouldn't you be? Like part of it is obviously because of, I know you've run into this so much where you read somebody that's rejecting the Catholic Church and it's like, you're not rejecting the Catholic Church. You're rejecting something that the church doesn't teach. And, but I'm wondering now, like why it's amazing. It's beautiful. I mean, I can't even begin to describe. Well, it just comes down to the true, the good, and the beautiful. And it's true because Jesus is true. It's beautiful because he's beautiful, and it's good because he's good. And it's the bride of Christ, and it's the body of Christ. And so I just want to appeal to evangelicals that love the Lord and love the Word of God to just, I honestly just say, just read the catechism. Just start there. So at least if you're going to object to the church, at least know that you're objecting to the church.
Yeah.
At least you know you're objecting to official doctrine and not what Lorraine Bettner says or Jack Chick draws up in one of his things. He's even around. I don't know if he's still around doing anything anymore, but or anybody else. There's more fair-minded Protestants and evangelicals out there. But read what the Catholic Church actually claims for itself, and you may come away really surprised. When I read the Catechism through the first time, I read it through in like 5 weeks. Just read it through. I had these big question marks. Mary, Queen of Heaven, what in the world is this? You know, and things like, talking about papacy and, communion of saints, whatever it is, big question marks. But I was blown away. I was like, this is not what I was told. When I read the Council of Trent all the way through, R.C. Sproul used to love to say that the Catholic Church anathematized the gospel at the Council of Trent. Then I read the Council of Trent all the way through and I realized they didn't anathematize anything except for Pelagianism and, a lot of other things that, almost every canon in the Council of Trent an evangelical should agree with.
Yeah,
there's like three of them that are kind of a shot across the bow. But most of them, it's like, first of all, it's what the church had always been teaching. And second of all, have you actually read the whole thing?
Yeah.
Then at least you could say, okay, well, these three are the ones that I disagree with. But don't disagree with a caricature. Don't the church is straw-manned a lot. It's an easy target. It's in the news. You can't pull the no true Scotsman as easily with the Catholic Church. You know, when an evangelical has a scandal and another, they can say, well, they don't really believe the Bible. They're not really part of us. We're not in that denomination. Catholic Church, we got to own it. It's our crazy uncle. He's in the family and it's a little bit of a bummer, but we're all family. I'm so grateful for God doing what he has done for my wife and I. So we'll see where it goes from here.
That's amazing. And you're absolutely right on that is the misconceptions.
Yeah.
Right. It's the idea. And you're literally the guy who was Catholic up to kind of confirmation, right? You is the kind of the trope that I went to Catholic high school, so I know what it means to be Catholic, right? Or I was baptized Catholic, so I know what it means to be Catholic. Yeah. Or we're Italian Canadian family, so we know what it means to be Catholic, right? But and so you have all these kind of mischaracterization of the Catholic Church, sometimes from those Catholics who I was raised Catholic, so I know. Well, were you catechized? Were you paying attention during Mass? Did you have good stuff to read? You know, were you really formed in that faith? And there are lots of reasons why. And I'm sure you have, you understand this from the ground floor perspective. There's reasons why those things don't happen and you aren't probably catechized or know what you believe necessarily or know what you're rejecting, right? But there comes a point for like the adult Christian, the adult evangelical, that has to take some responsibility for knowing what they're right. The Catholic Church teaches this, so I reject them. Well, do they teach that? Like, you have a responsibility. Mm. I think as a grown person, if you are going to say, you guys stop believing this, believe this, you're wrong. Well, look into what you think the Catholic Church is doing that's wrong, and really ask questions. Right, like my friend Joshua Charles on the show recently, amazing guy, very active on Twitter. Adam on the show. It was a phenomenal conversation. He is very active in this space. And one, you know, the question that he often asks that I think is so important to ask is the crucial question. Is like, you know, are you willing to be wrong on the ideas you have of the Catholic Church? Are you willing to look into those ideas and go, wait a minute, am I maybe mistaken? Am I maybe understanding a misrepresentation or a misunderstanding here? Is it possible that I have learned something or believe something that's wrong about Catholics?
Well, and in fact, he was one of the guests that you had on recently that I failed to mention. I stumbled across his website somewhere early in my journey. I don't even know how I found it. I don't know if I found it. It was on his series on there. Is he called Becoming Catholic?
Yeah.
think that's his series. And he might've been my gateway to the early church. And from there, I can't remember exactly the sequence.
That's great.
But I found his website and I thought, I didn't even know this existed. Yeah. And I think it was quotes from Justin Martyr and others. So shout out to Joshua Charles. And I watched your episode with him the other day and it was just fantastic. He's got some great stuff. He's quite an accomplished, quite an accomplished man and doing great things for the church. So
it's phenomenal. I think his question is so important, right? If you aren't willing, if you're a person saying, you know what, I believe this about Catholics, but I'm not willing to say maybe I'm wrong. Well, then there's something stuck in that kind of perspective, I think, right? If you're not willing to say maybe I am wrong about what I think they believe, and I think it's those kind of those beginnings, like Doug Beaumont talks about, that kind of pebble in your shoe, that thing that you begin to chip away at, like that niggling thing. Well, okay, let me give them an inch here and see if they actually believe this. And then, well, if they believe that, maybe they believe this. Mm-hmm. See? And you begin to realize that you had all these misconceptions all along. Like you said you were deeply anti-Catholic, right? You were kind of catechized deeply anti-Catholic. You had a lot of work to do to dispel those things, but you said it was reading all these books and dispelling those misconceptions, right? Not things that you had to go, oh, well, they worship Mary, now I'm okay with them worshiping Mary, right? I'm okay with that now, right? That's fine. No, they never worshiped Mary, but you had to come to a place where you understood what was actually happening there, right? For that to become something that you could understand and accept to become Catholic, right?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, the ones that, you know, that think that Catholics worship Mary or the other saints, I'm thinking, did you ever read Thomas Aquinas? Did you ever you ever realize that Thomas Aquinas considers God pure act, and that there's really no comparison between the creator and the created, the eternal and the temporal, the creator and the, and his creation. And so Mary is a creation, and Catholics understand this distinction. No matter how much honor they give to Mary, they understand the distinction between Mary, hyperdulia, I mean, the tremendous honor that we give to her as the mother of God, but she's not God. She's not God. And Catholics know that. And I think there's a deep prejudice that runs through oftentimes the Protestant mind. There was in my own. It was just a prejudice. I mean, I was prejudiced against my own upbringing. I was offended that I was raised that way. I thought you hid the gospel from me, and I was angry at the church. But so I think it's, you can read, but there still has to be a conversion of the heart. That's my wife and I, we read like crazy and we continue to read like crazy. But along the way, I mean, God is converting the heart. There's a point at which it was like, I'm stumbling over things, Keith, but I'm like, at some point I got to where I was like, I want this to be true. And I don't know why I want it to be true, but I want to find the answers here because there is something so compelling. Was it Blaise Pascal that said that you don't always, not always willing to consider the truth of something until you behold its beauty, something to that effect. So once we beheld the beauty, we were really compelled, but there was a change in the heart so that we wanted to see what the Catholic Church really was, what it claimed to be, warts and all. And there's plenty of warts. There's plenty of history there to poke holes in. And, you know, I just decided I'm just going to own it. In fact, I was at RCIA. I joined our RCIA team at our church, and you had the guest on the other day talking about RCIA, and that was hilarious.
Taylor, yeah.
Because my youngest daughter and son-in-law are in RCIA right now, I'm so excited about. They're going to be coming in and here in 2 weeks at the Easter Vigil, but I'm there every Thursday with them. Amazing. And it's just like you guys described. It was so funny. Even when you do look at some of the history that, you know, there's some spots and wrinkles there, but it's the bride of Christ.
Yeah.
And, you know, by God's grace till my dying breath, I'm going to love the bride of Christ and hopefully get many opportunities to defend her and to share the love I have for the bride of Christ, obviously because of the bridegroom. So, we're just super grateful for the things that God's doing in our life. Just
that's,
want to keep going.
That's fantastic. Gerard, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. I can see more in our future if you're ready and willing, because there's lots we can unpack, I think, going forward. I can picture like a star-studded Francis Beckwith, Gerard Figarelli, Doug Beaumont, like a special, right?
Where I'll just sit in the background when those guys get on.
That'd be fantastic. Unwind those journeys. That's it. I mean, it's a great story. I'm so happy to have you here to tell your story.
Thanks for having me.
I want to give you a chance. I know you're working on some stuff. So I wonder if you want to give listeners a chance to figure out where they could find or follow you now or in the near future, perhaps. I don't know. Where do you want to point them towards so they can see more of your stuff?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, I had a website. I still have a website. I won't give anybody the website address because it's stale. I stopped updating it 4 years ago, and obviously 4 years ago I was not Catholic. So, but I decided a couple months ago that I was going to give YouTube a try, and so I'm starting a YouTube channel. I'm getting some videos going, working on it. I'm sending them out kind of quietly to some of my kids and other people. Say, okay, just bash me, and you know, just tell me what I need to improve, because it's not really my strong point. So, but I'm gonna hopefully within the next few days have this YouTube channel up, and you can find it by going to at Midair Fortress Revert, or just look up the Midair Fortress. And again, it gets back to my imagery of having this theological fortress built in midair and finally finding a grounding for it. And now it's found a home in the Catholic Church. So Midair Fortress, I'm going to put up some videos on some of the things that I've learned, maybe do occasional, some gospel reflections. One of the things that I want to do is I've gotten some requests from some friends, that are Catholic who have a lot of Protestants in their circle that they're trying to influence. And they're like, what book could I give them? You know, do you have a good idea for a book for this subject? And so one of the things I want to do is, since books have been such a big part of my reversion, as it is typically, I want to do some, not really book reviews, but just videos just saying, hey, this book really helped me out a lot. This is why, and this is why I think you should consider reading it. Like I got one up on Stephen Wood's book, Grace and Justification, because of how much it influenced my understanding of justification and as a Catholic now. And so, and I'll do others like that. I did a countdown from the five books that influenced me the most. And I've got some more I want to put up. So got some ideas, just have to figure out some of the mechanics of YouTube and some of the aesthetics. My wife helps me out with a lot of that, 'cause she's way better at that than I am. I just, you know, and then, you know, maybe some other things. I'm going to keep the website dead for a while. I think I just don't have the energy to update it, and I don't have the know-how, but we'll stick with YouTube for now. And, I think that'd be the best way.
That sounds good. That's wonderful. Happy to have you join the YouTube space. I think you have great stuff to add. That sounds like some awesome ideas.
Probably get kicked off in a month.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Well, I'll put links to that in the show notes description for this video. Either way, so listeners and viewers can go and find that or not find it if you're kicked off.
Yeah, hopefully not.
Either way, Gerard, thank you so much for being here. I'm so glad to meet you and encounter you. Space, your story is fantastic. I want to say God bless you, the awesome work you're doing. You've done, are doing, and are going to keep on doing for the church. It's awesome.
God's grace. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. It's been a real
pleasure. Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Like I said, I feel like I've known you for a long time, and it's just great to finally get a chance to talk with you.
I hope you weren't too disappointed.
God bless you.
God bless. Thanks, Gerard. Okay. Well, thank you once again for listening to the Cordial Catholic Podcast, guys. Thank you so much. I appreciate so many ways you guys for allowing me, enabling me through your support, through your listening, through your financial giving, through your subscribing to our channel and following the show, for having a space to have conversations like this one. I feel very grateful to be able to do this now for 5 years of this show that you guys actually enjoy listening to, and I mean are experiencing and appreciating and making life-changing decisions based on some of these conversations. You know, Gerard and I chatted after the show for a bit, and he talked about all the ways that guests on this show, this very show that he's now been on, impacted his wife and himself and their journey so fundamentally. Guys like Rod Bennett, guys like Doug Beaumont, guys like Joe Heschmeyer, Jimmy Akin, these amazing guests that we've had on the show, thanks to you guys and your support, right? If this show was just a nothing show that nobody listened to, if you weren't listening and no one's listening, well, it wouldn't happen. So thank you for listening and your support. It's amazing. It's humbling. And I really appreciate all you guys out there. So thank you. CordialCatholic@gmail.com is our email address. Find us on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram @CordialCatholic, The Cordial Catholic on Facebook, or TheCordialCatholic.com for our website. To watch what you're hearing, it's YouTube.com/TheCordialCatholic. And guys, thank you. Thanks for listening. Please pray for me. Know that I'm praying for you too. Talk to you again next week and every week. Thanks for listening. Take care and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.